everyone, and welcome back to another week here at the Damage Report. Today is a Monday. Mondays are two things here. One, they tend to be pretty fantastic. And also, now recently, they are our Super Subs Day, where we try to expand and better our community by bringing people into it, occasionally by gifting subs, if that's a thing that's available on a platform you're on. It's just a nice thing to do. You know what else is nice? Our guest, Francesca Fiorentini. How's it going, Francesca?
What's up, John? So good to be here once again, back on a Monday, fully vaxxed, still inside, not there.
No, you're not here yet, but soon, and I'm sure you're very excited for that commute. But anyway, glad to have you here. I haven't talked to you in what seems like forever, but you've got a show. I don't recall what it's about or what it's called, but what's that show thing that you sometimes, you still do that? Do you do the show?
Yeah, we had this like, I don't know, really uppity celebrity cameo last night. I don't know, you know when like someone feels like they're too good and too cool for school and they come in, they waltz in your podcast, like what's this, is it a podcast? This guy named Jine Yadayadarola.
Don't know him, sounds niche. But anyway, yeah,
DJ Lunchbox.
Had an awesome episode.
Yes, DJ Lunchbox was on the Bituation Room, which is my podcast. And so if you like John and you like me, you're gonna like what happened last night. So listen wherever you get your podcasts or watch back at Franny Fio on my YouTube channel.
Yeah, and I'm gonna be vague. You seem like the sort of person who would not want to do a big announcement of big personal life news. So I'll just continue on with the show or?
Well, now that you teased it, I must announce to the world that yes, I'm getting married. I think I'm engaged. When you say yes, guys, just let me know. When someone gets down on one knee with a ring and is like, will you marry me? Does that mean I'm engaged? I think so. I said yes.
You're wholly engaged.
Okay.
You're like full on engaged. Yes.
Yes.
You are a fiance.
It's a smart move on his part. You know, it's like you come out of the pandemic and you're like, oh, before you can actually see what else is out there, I'm gonna lock it in right here. You see this thinking?
He's a smart guy, clearly. No, but that's awesome. And people seem really excited in the chat. So that's cool. Thank you for taking part in that thing I sort of twisted your arm into doing right here. Yay. Anyway, so thank you, everybody, for being here and you know, watching the show, participating in our Subs Day spectacular. Today's also being a Monday, the day where we do our big top 10 list. And we decided to do one sort of tied in with the news of the weekend, which had to do with pop culture, specifically SNL, which will come up sort of tangentially in one of our stories later on the show. We are going to be doing a top 10 list geared at providing some assistance to one Lorne Michaels. These are the top 10 people we would like to see host SNL rather than you just choosing another awful billionaire. So maybe this will help him out and help us out too. So we will be doing that later on, available to our tier 2 and tier 3 members on YouTube. Now that said, Francesca, are you ready to launch into this hour of news?
Have I ever not been ready except for saying those words right now?
I don't know, just sort of a ritual.
I'm always ready. I'm ready, John. I'm ready. Let's do
it. Okay, then let's do it. I guess we'll do it then. At some point you'll say no and then we'll just end the show. But now I guess we'll do the news. Over the weekend, Dr. Anthony Fauci announced that perhaps with the way things have been going vaccination-wise, some of the mask mandates might begin to change in the near future. He said that as vaccinations climb, quote, we do need to start being more liberal in terms of rules for wearing masks indoors. Though he noted that the nation was still averaging about 43,000 cases of the virus daily, quote, we've got to get it much, much lower than that. And I have to say, I've been tracking the deaths and I've been tracking LA COVID cases. I hadn't realized it was still above 40,000 cases a day, Francesca. That is like, that's what it was like between the second and third waves, basically. It hung in that 40 to 50 range. Now, obviously, deaths are down because older people are much more likely to have been vaccinated, but that is still a lot of COVID out there on a daily basis.
Yeah, that it is. It really is. And it seems like people are already being pretty lax about the mask indoors thing. So I'm not sure if Dr. Fauci, you know, bless him, but like, I just feel like we need to constantly err on the side of caution. Like, I feel like we just got through the idea that maybe fully vaxxed people could be outdoors and not wear a mask, which is great, you know, and like perfect. That's fine. I want to breathe, you know, air without, you know, a surgical mask in between me and fresh air. But yeah, 40,000 cases a day. And let's just remind everyone, if you don't know someone with long COVID, get to know someone. Listen to their stories. I have a friend who's dealing with long COVID, got it early on, about a year ago, and is still struggling every single day. Some days she's terrible, some days she's fine, some days she doesn't have a pounding migraine. It is not okay. People are stuck like this. She's a young woman, my age, right? Just like, you know, a cool 19 years old. And these are serious side effects. So even if you do get it, like, there is not a chance that this, it could wash right through you, but it could also completely latch onto you and be like, no, you're gonna be mine for the next however long. This is not a game, people. It's not good to get this. So
yeah, you're right. And also, like, you're saying err on the side of caution. Like, whatever gets put out, whether it's by the CDC or by Biden or by Fauci, by the time it hits the population with how tired and anti-government they are, they're not gonna do anything like what they're being asked to do anyway. So you feel like if you want to get something like caution, you have to err on the side of lots of caution, because it is going to be weakened the farther it goes from the CDC. Now, that said, sometimes it seems like the CDC's guidance is a bit behind the times. I don't know, maybe I'm the bad guy. I'm gonna read this graphic and you let me know if you feel like this is as weird as I felt. So on Friday, the CDC updated its guidance about how the coronavirus spreads, stating explicitly that people could inhale airborne virus even when they're more than 6 feet away from an infected individual. Previously, the agency had said that most infections were acquired through close contact, not airborne transmission. I don't, maybe they're using the word airborne differently than I, like, I think anything that goes through the air is airborne. Maybe they mean something that, for it to be airborne, it has to go farther, last longer. But their new guidance sounds like what I think we've all thought for a very long time is how it works.
Yep.
It goes out of your body and it swirls around a little bit and then it goes into someone else's body. Isn't that pretty much what it was? Maybe this is just a terminology thing.
I mean, yeah, I think I'm glad they're clarifying it. I'm glad as they know more. But yes, this feels like something we knew about 6 months ago when we were like, oh, we don't have to wipe down all of our packages. Cool, I guess that's good. I'm not like, you know, yeah, like sanitizing canned beans. But it also shows, you know, early on in the pandemic, you saw, I think the New York Times had a graphic about people eating at a restaurant next to one another, and that folks at the same table didn't necessarily get infected as the person who had COVID, but the people two tables down who were underneath the same ventilation system did get infected. So these are people who are more than 6 feet away. So I think any indoor situation really is sus. It's difficult to say. And it's difficult to say, you know, if everyone's got the HEPA filters, if they even are, you know, really working as we think they might be working. But yeah, even if you are a distance from someone indoors, you should probably be wearing a mask. I mean, that's what I would be doing. But
yeah. And if this debate annoys you, if you're like, oh God, well, they keep changing what they're saying, and it's like, oh, well, they're indicating that we might like loosen up, but so far we're not, just get vaccinated.
Exactly.
Just get vaccinated. Francesca's vaccinated, I'm vaccinated. We still have this debate, but you don't have to. If you get vaccinated, you'll be almost certainly safe and all of that. Now, thankfully, a lot of people have, although not as many as I would like. Over a third of the US population, more than 112 million people are fully vaccinated, and another 40 million have received the first dose of a two-dose protocol. That is good, although those numbers have been slowing. And I want to give you one more comment from Dr. Fauci. He says, I mean, if we get, which we will, to the goals that the president has established, namely, if we get 70% of the people vaccinated by the 4th of July, and we're only like halfway there, namely one single dose and even more thereafter, you may see blips. But if we handle them well, it is unlikely that you'll see the kind of surge that we saw in the late fall and the early winter. That's the reason why vaccinations are so important. That's the wild card that we have now that we didn't have last fall or last winter. And again, like, I'm glad that he's out there communicating. For me, when I read that, I think, what do you mean it's unlikely that we'll get that sort of blip in the late fall, the early winter with like 70% vaccinated? Like, how could we possibly have deaths anywhere near approaching that with so many people vaccinated? Like, I guess it's that thing where they just have to speak carefully and super cautiously. But it seems to me like, doesn't that have to be massively underplaying the situation that's likely to exist by then, by the end of this year?
He's constantly between a rock and a hard place, though. Like, that's no matter what, you know, there is gonna be still, and we've talked about them, like the segment of the population for whom the pandemic has become so politicized that they won't take basic precautions to protect their own lives, their own families, and their friends and communities. Not to mention random strangers who they could kill, right? And so it really doesn't matter. I mean, if he said, like, you know, we are going to have a surge unless you get vaccinated, people will be like, well, then what's the point of the vaccination? And you're like, no, but wait, like everything, everyone's looking for an out. Everyone thinks they're the medical expert. And the answer is you're not.
I guess.
And you don't know. No, you're like, no, you're Googling. No, that's not helping. So, but you know what I'm saying? Like, that's why he speaks, I think, in this way, which can be frustrating, understandably, for those of us trying to interpret it. But like erring on like not too much, you know, finger wagging, because otherwise it's like, yeah, well then why have we all done this sort of massive vax rollout? We need to create more confidence in it versus not.
Yeah. As you say, you're fighting against people that have been trained to believe that doing a quick Google search is sufficient, or you know, getting like the true news from some guy on YouTube in a room with the walls painted black and a sign that says fight the new world order or something. Like, he probably really knows what's going on. CDC, they don't know what they're talking about. So yeah, that is true. You have to err on the side of caution. Additionally, I did want to let you know, he also said later on that masks could become seasonal going forward, that people might get somewhat used to it. And then would wear it during certain seasons to both avoid, you know, both COVID popping back up, potentially variants for it, and also theoretically things like the flu and stuff like that. I know that any conversation about mask wearing, like us not reaching a point where we all set fire to our masks simultaneously, is going to cause people's heads to explode. But it kind of does make a little bit of sense. Like, the flu does suck and a lot of people get it. Like, would it be the worst thing if we sort of learned and developed a new sort of social dress protective thing occasionally to keep ourselves safe in crowded places? I don't know. Do you think it's going to be weird to wear one in like a year or two?
No, in fact, in the idea of it being seasonal is actually kind of music to my ears. Like, it makes me feel like, oh good, well then we'll at least have a lot of time where we don't have to wear masks and I can be comfortable. And then times where I have to be a little bit more cautious, and that makes absolute sense to me. And look at the ways that things like SARS and the avian bird flu or whatever, swine flu, those places changed. China, South Korea, you know, like Philippines, all these Asian countries that have been through this before. This isn't their first rodeo when it comes to these pandemics. And they do that all the time, and they do that to protect others. And so there is two things happening. So it's like, one, there's a cultural shift, and we need to make sure that we can be open to that cultural shift, no matter the amount of xenophobia coming down at us. And two, I think, is that xenophobia is the like, no, I'm not gonna change anything. And it's a very me first attitude, where I think other countries have developed a more communal and community oriented understanding of living. And sadly, we've eroded that in this country, if we ever really had it.
Yeah, I think if we ever did, it was a very close knit insular thing. My church, maybe my neighborhood, than only people of my race. Yeah, I agree. 4 months now on this program, we have been going out of our way searching for opportunities to give credit to right wingers for doing the bare minimum, including Donald Trump, a guy I really hate to give credit to. So today we turn to Ainsley Earhart and Fox and Friends trying to encourage people to get vaccinated.
From what? It's 96% effective. You can't carry the virus. What are you protecting us from?
I will say there is so much freedom. I understand there are people that have vaccine hesitancy, mm-hmm. but we all three are vaccinated. And I will tell you, when I got it, it was just like, okay.
A relief.
Now, exactly. Yeah. Now I know I'm not going to get it. I'm not right. going to die from it if I do get it. There's a small percentage of a chance that you could get it.
Right. But it's the people who have not gotten the shot, which, you know, ultimately they're the ones who are in peril. And they're
one note, don't call getting the vaccine getting shot. That's weird. But yeah, maybe I went too far, Francesca, in saying that they're encouraging people to get vaccinated, because they do repeatedly say after that, we're not saying you should or we shouldn't. We're just talking about how awesome it is and how much safer you'll get. And I can't come up with any reason why you wouldn't, but we understand you guys are crazy, so we're not saying you should. But there, she did say that they all got vaccinated and that they felt free as a result of it.
I think Fox News reflects what is happening more broadly in the Republican Party, and I'm like fascinated. I mean, I'm terrified by Fox News, but mostly like sociologically fascinated by like how they play all of this, like how they play science, you know. And I think, you know, they are trying to appeal to obviously still a Trump and anti-vax base, but that's not necessarily like where they come from, you know. Like that's, they know. I don't know. I'm just like how many people are still watching Fox, you know, who haven't already turned it off? I know the answer is a lot. Chat, don't get mad at me. Yeah, I understand the answer is probably a whole hell of a lot of people. But exactly. I mean, they should really be and herald it. If you, we've talked about this before many times, John. If Trump helped pharmacies develop some sort of rollout, which is, you know, seems to be the one good thing that the administration did, talk about that. If Trump himself, you know, like if under their administration they give a bunch of money to Moderna, talk about that. Talk about how great Big Pharma is, you know, like just you love corporations, like continue to talk about that. You love Trump. It is very easy for them to spin this and to try and like snatch it from the victory of Biden, even though we know it's Biden who actually implemented it. But they don't have any. This is like a one little blip. It's a one like where folks like us are like, oh, look, they did get vaccinated. Now to just talk about how Anthony Fauci is, you know, a worm for the next week.
Yeah. And you're right. The rest of that segment was a lot of, I mean, you saw Brian Kilmeade going crazy at the beginning. That was like a minute long rant about how, well, you said the vaccine's great, so why do I need to ever do anything? I still have to wash my hands. yeah, there's definitely a lot of that. And there's a lot of, we're not saying you should. We would never say that you should do that. Yeah, they'd never moralize or anything like that. And so there's all that bad context. That said, I'm not comparing them to reasonable, rational people. I'm comparing them to the rest of Fox. Mm-hmm. And so them saying, I got vaccinated, you got vaccinated, you got vaccinated, and we're better now is better than most of them will do. And so to contrast, Tucker Carlson has been doing nightly rants, making up BS about the vaccine as red meat for his increasingly anti-vax audience. And yet we know, I'll just say it, like, I don't know, but I know, and you don't know, but
you know,
he's vaccinated and his family's vaccinated. Of course they are. He doesn't want to die of COVID or have long-term health impacts, have his lungs all chewed up. He just doesn't really care if you do. So he does all this stuff about vaccines, every once in a while throwing out, and I'm not anti-vaccine, I'm just gonna do 45 minutes where I use this online database where literally anyone can upload anything they want to pretend that lots of people are dying from it. I'm just gonna do that over and over and over again. And all the while, he will not say whether he got it or not. And that is starting to irk people. It actually came up, there was an ER doctor that went on CNN and had this to say about Tucker Carlson.
He's really a saboteur. That's what I think of Tucker Carlson. Every night he has a million questions about this vaccine. Somehow, magically, he has no one on his show that can answer these questions. I'm willing to answer these questions. And I have a question, I have two questions for Tucker Carlson. Number one, have you been vaccinated?
Right.
And number two, why won't you tell your audience whether you've been vaccinated? I'm tired of his really his nonsense.
Yeah. Francesca, I mean, we know why, because he doesn't want to burst his grifty bubble. And also he's a coward. Like, He is a coward. He wants to give these people what they want. He's terrified of them turning on him. And he knows how easy it is for them to say something that causes them to be jettisoned by their audience. Question Trump, question the anti-vax propaganda, imply that the election was legitimate or that COVID was a threat. It is that easy for your audience to just evaporate, and he is terrified of that happening. And so he is going to pretend that maybe I was, maybe I wasn't. We'll never know. I don't want to say that I'm not, because that's potentially a lie that could be shown to be a lie. And other people are asking. So hashtag Tucker Vax, that was trending on Twitter earlier, because everybody knows that he was, but he is just too cowardly to actually admit it.
No, and if he ever does, it'll be like, sure, I've gotten the vaccine, but like that was my decision. And you see, I don't care if you actually live or die, because I'm slowly grooming you into an early grave by filling your brain with straight poison from my lips to your supple, ignorant ears. Like, this is his grift, and it's more than a grift. This was proven all of 2020, and we couldn't believe it, because I guess we're weak and we believe that you shouldn't encourage folks to kill one another.
Yeah.
But you know, even us were like, well, of course the right wing media and even Trump is gonna maybe seize this moment to be like, I am the hero, I believe in science, but and no. Exactly like that. It'd be a musical. But they didn't, because they don't care. They don't care if their audience dies. It's worse than just misinformation or being afraid that you're going to lose your audience. It's that you're not afraid if they literally are lost. If they die, you don't value their lives. You don't, and it's perfect, because you don't value their lives enough to not tell them the truth. You don't value their lives enough to tell them how to protect themselves. This is media 101. I mean, we've talked about like the fairness doctrine. We've talked about the ways that media gets to, and news outlets get to say whatever they want. We've reached a breaking point. Like, what is it going to take to have some actual reform that they will absolutely call, you know, stopping free speech or whatever the F, right? You are a primetime news show, and you're spreading lies like this that's leading to people's deaths? Nuh-uh. There has to be some kind of accountability. And I think we've reached the edge here.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it'll be. I mean, the funny thing is, not that, you know, Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson, all their lies about social distancing, about masks, about hydroxychloroquine, about vaccines, all that, that hasn't had consequence. It's that Trish Regan got fired for like spreading nonsense about the coronavirus early on, like when she said that it was their made up like hoax or whatever.
Yeah.
She like that, how frustrated must she be that she was the one that got fired for saying way less than the others did? But anyway, no, I think Tucker Carlson is probably gonna be just fine.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
I I'm sure at this point you're aware that there has been a massive amount of violence in Jerusalem, literally hundreds of Palestinians being injured. And we're gonna dive into a couple different aspects of this. But in case you haven't seen some of the footage, I wanna show you a bit of video that I actually saw. Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib had spread on Twitter. This is not just videos of the massive overreaction of the security forces using rubber bullets and smoke and flashbangs, but this is video inside of Al-Aqsa Mosque. Like, it is basically impossible to overstate how important this particular mosque is in Islam, but here is how it was being treated over the past few days. It was turned into a war zone, effectively. You have, like, you saw the people that they were standing there. They went to the mosque to pray. Like, that's what they did. They just wanted to worship. And again, like I was saying, it is impossible to overstate how important it is. Like, I don't, like, even making comparisons, like, to imagine them throwing grenades in Notre Dame or something like that, that's not actually even on the same level. Mm-hmm. So look, we're gonna get into more of sort of the causes of this and everything, but I am glad that there is worldwide condemnation of the behavior that we're seeing, the massive violence and injuries and all of that, Francesca.
That is so hard to watch. I mean, I just wanna just kind of send love out to all the Muslim family and friends and progressives in this country and around the world who are celebrating Ramadan right now, who are in their holiest month of the year. This is a time that is sacred. And to see something like that, man, it really is disgusting. It's painful. And sadly, it's par for the course when it comes to Israel and their treatment of Palestinians. And I want people to know that this is not the same. This is not your everyday violence that is waged in the West Bank, in Gaza. This is different. This is Jerusalem, which has always been, you know, a shared territory, a shared zone between Israel and Palestine. This is why the capital or the US embassy was not in Jerusalem, because of what the message that it might send to the Israelis, that the United States, you know, did not consider this holy site a shared site. And clearly now we see the consequences of that an even more emboldened Israel can now set off flashbang grenades. We've heard those before. We know that from the summer and right in the BLM demonstrations.
Yep.
In the middle of this mosque, I have no words. It's disgusting.
Yeah, and I want to talk about, especially for our US audience, a little bit of what has led to this. Understand in advance, I apologize in advance for what is going to be a massive oversimplification of obviously complex topics. But there are a couple of different things that are very close time-wise to what's going on. So one had to do with what was going to be this yearly march through the area, through an area predominantly businesses and residences of Muslim inhabitants of this area for Jerusalem Day. And that was considered and always has been considered every year that it's done as a provocation. Well, there was a lot of pushback against that. And as of this morning, the breaking news is that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rerouted the provocative flag parade held in honor of Jerusalem Day, came after a day of near constant clashes. These numbers are gonna be super out of date even as of this morning, but there had been more than 300 Palestinians injured at that point, including 7 who were hospitalized in serious condition. Now, thankfully, at least that was changed. So the parade route was changed. But in the lead up to it, I mean, you saw the footage. Israeli police were using tear gas and stun grenades and water cannons and rubber bullets against some protesters who threw rocks and water bottles. No reports yet of soup, but I'm sure those are forthcoming or they're about to come. And the violence is continuing. Now, obviously, Benjamin Netanyahu has a side in this. He's backed the police for their handling of it, even as the rest of the world has been calling out for the violence against the Palestinians to stop. He described it as a struggle for the heart of the city and said that Israel was committed to ensuring the rights of everyone to pursue their faith. But it was a little bit hard to hear him saying that over the flashbangs in the mosque. So a little bit hard to really hear and absorb that message about everyone's faith being important and respected.
It's continues to be the most disingenuous, dare I say, genocidal line of like, look, you just need to behave and we're gonna stop murdering you. Just behave. And this is the way that it is often represented in American media, that these are clashes. This is not just an assault. And a lot of this was spurred. Yes, there's, you know, the commemoration, you know, sort of this annual peace march. And then there is the violent expulsion of Palestinians from a neighborhood in Jerusalem called Sheikh Jarrah. I hope I'm pronouncing that somehow correctly. And this is what happens when you have a settler nation trying to steadily encroach on an indigenous population. It continues and continues and continues. And these settlements often happen, you know, sort of farther into the West Bank and not necessarily in these neighborhoods in Jerusalem. But this is not a you didn't pay your rent eviction. This is a you have to go. This is Israel's now eviction. Mm-hmm. And this has been, this is the struggle of the Palestinian people, right? This is a struggle, an international struggle, and one that the United States has consistently been on the side of Israel in the form of something to the tune of $3 billion a year in military aid, right? If not more, military aid. So we are squarely on the side of Netanyahu, no matter what comes out of the mouths of people in Washington, and that hasn't changed. And there, we need to absolutely, if nothing else, stop funding this kind of violence. Stop being able to be at a place where we can actually say, yeah, no, our thumb isn't on the scale. Because right now, it is on the scale. And that scale is of occupation and of violence.
100%, yeah. Yeah, and you know, Congresswoman Tlaib actually mentioned that as well. So I'm gonna jump ahead a little bit, but she pointed out in a thread about the video that she showed and the context of it. She said, 330, 75% of my colleagues, D's and R's, pledged not to condition the billions we send to Israel's army. Days later, the apartheid state resumed forced population replacement in Sheikh Jarrah. Now we see grenades, bullets, and tear gas shot into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We're gonna give you billions of dollars. We could, in theory, say that the continued supply of that funds is going to be contingent on maintaining basic standards of human rights and those sorts of things. We're not going to, which makes sense if you just want to give the money and you really don't care what's done with it. That's what you do. If you cared about what's done with it, well, then you would do the standards. We are, after all, giving billions of dollars. That should, in theory, be able to buy you something like basic respect for people's humanity. They chose not to purchase that and to just give it instead. And so you're totally right there. By the way, someone in the audience, Kevin Parsons, says this would be like lighting the Vatican on fire during Easter service.
Yes.
And look, I'm not a Muslim, I'm not a Catholic or a Christian. I don't know if the analogy is perfect, but it seems close. It seems something like that. In any event, I did want to give a little bit more information about the expulsions that you were talking about there, Francesca. So a pro-settler organization called Nahalat Shimon is using a 1970 law to argue that the owners of the land before 1948 were Jewish families. And so the current Palestinian landowners should be evicted and their properties given to Israeli Jews before 1948. Now, I want you to take a look at, so they are trying to force these people out. Obviously, the families and those defending them don't want them to. Here is a statement put out by the Israeli Foreign Ministry. Regrettably, the PA and Palestinian terror groups are presenting a real estate dispute between private parties as a nationalistic cause in order to incite violence in Jerusalem. Okay, so the people who are potentially going to be forced out of their homes, as so many Palestinians have been, they are taking this private real estate dispute and turning it into something nationalistic. It's not part of a nationalistic campaign to get these people out of all these different lands. And they're encouraging the violence. Well, why wouldn't they? Violence always helps so much for the Palestinian cause. They're certainly not the ones who absorb 99% of it or anything like that. It's just a, like, the injury obviously is a substance of what we're talking about. That is an insult on top of it from the foreign ministry right there.
Absolutely. But this is, again, par for the course. And you know, you give an inch and Israel will take it. And I just want to say, I want to name something, which is that this is at a time when Israel's also been systematically denying the vaccine access for so many Palestinians and Palestinian residents because of the incredible sanctions that they have on places like Gaza that prevent basic medical supplies from getting into that territory, to the amount of checkpoints, to not allowing Palestinians to come into Israel and get vaccinated. No. Meanwhile, they're heralded as an international success story when it comes to this pandemic. Well, they're not. So this is at that time. This is during Ramadan. And on top of that, there are Palestinian elections coming up, the first in, I believe, over a decade. Mm-hmm. And the strategy that Israel has employed for many, many, many years now, when it comes to dissolving, weakening, and radicalizing the Palestinian resistance, is by provoking, is basically by taking out and taking out any moderates, anyone, you know, who's like, that's why he's like, they're throwing the PA in there, you know, the Palestinian mm-hmm. Authority, arguably moderates, not negotiating, right, like basically killing all the moderates. And so there are like more extremist, supposedly extremist organizations left. Hamas, I wouldn't argue, isn't necessarily an extremist organization. It legitimately won a democratic election that then Israel does not support because they call it an extremist organization. So you understand what happens here? It's this, the idea of divide and conquer, the idea of pushing people so far to the brink that their only response is potentially violence, because literally they have nothing else to live for. They have nothing else going on. And then you say, oh, look at how violent the Palestinians are. It's a set them up, knock them down situation, tale as old as time when it comes to colonialism and settlements.
Yeah. And like the last step is those statements, they're just projection. They're the ones that are doing it.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. No, I think that you're 100% right. Appreciate that. Jeff Bezos has a new hobby. We all do in the pandemic. Some people did sourdough starters. I bought a typewriter. He's building a yacht. It's not even a yacht anymore. At some point, it's a country that floats. So this is the Y721. When it's completed, it will be 417 feet long, span several decks, and sport three enormous masts, according to the limited amount of information that's currently available from its manufacturer. And you can get some information from various online bulletin boards of yachting enthusiasts. That will make it one of the largest sailing yachts ever built in the Netherlands, the unofficial capital of boat building for the extremely rich. So he is currently, it says, the wealthiest person on the planet, although people also say that that's Elon Musk. I don't know. Take your pick. So he owns the boat. It's set to move to a new shipyard for completion next month. It is going to cost upward of $500 million. It will have its own support yacht, thus finally making real that meme of, yo, put a yacht in your yacht so your yacht can have yachts or something like that. It's going to have a helipad, obviously. But I think the support yacht has a helipad too. You know, why not? In case like you accidentally like leave something on the main one, you can land your helicopter on the second one. So we've got more on this, but like Francesca, this year has been so terrible. And this guy is gonna make a yacht that costs twice what it cost him to buy the Washington Post, but now in boat form.
It is truly dystopian. This is where we are, people. I mean, it's the latest stage of capitalism. And this is what it is. Here we go. I mean, I would like to say boycott Amazon, but I feel like it's not even gonna work at this point. We gotta sink that yacht. I'm just kidding, obviously. No. No, we don't. We leave it alone.
We're not making a call for pirates or not starting a crew or anything,
but
you know?
If a crew resembling the Goonies did happen to roll up and, you know, some altercation were to happen with Jeff Bezos's giant yacht.
Hey, you billionaires. I could go for that.
This is like the revolution, man. This is the whole thing. It was like, down here, this is our time. Up there, that's where Bezos is.
No, that's what you're gonna hear from the kids that are shoveling coal in. I know they don't run on coal. They're on the lower decks.
Yes.
Down here. Oh God, he's doing so well. $500 million. And like, I'm sure it's gonna be beautiful or whatever, but like.
No. What? It's ostentatious and ridiculous, and nobody needs something like that. I can't wait for when the rev comes and we reappropriate that for the people, mm-hmm. and we have like, you know, cafes and bookstores and pools and hangouts and just like, you know, whatever, finger paint. That's not, I don't want finger paint, but you know what I'm saying? That yacht is gonna be the people's yacht. Follow me to victory, everybody. We're doing this.
Obviously, we don't support political violence and or piracy on the high seas. We've been very consistent about that.
But if it's docked, it's fair game. Oh,
that's
okay.
True. Yeah, totally. I don't know. Seems like a bad signal to send to the suffering billions that you can afford to basically make your own city on a boat. Like, I guess I've been wanting them to do a remake of Waterworld, which is about this sort of apocalypse that, you know, results in people being on boats. But what if like, it's not that the seas have risen too much, although that is definitely happening and he's not doing anything to help it. But like, there's still land, but it sucks now. And they're all on their own self-sufficient boats. Maybe I'll write that.
You know what they say, that a rising tide lifts all yachts, even the little yachts, the helipad yacht. See, mm-hmm. you can't say
that. It works.
It works. The money does trickle down. No, it is. I think it is a slap in the face to every worker, and especially given what just happened in Bessemer, what just happened with the union vote, and all of the ways that Amazon is trying to squeeze more and more out of its overworked workforce and skirt, you know, not just labor regulations, but also paying their fair share in taxes. I mean, if you needed a better example of why we fundamentally need a revolution of political values, a revolution of our tax structure, a revolution of our economy. Look at this stupid, stupid, stupid yacht.
Yep. Yeah, and someone was like, it's a cruise ship. And then someone else on Twitch responded, it's not a cruise ship. Poor people are allowed on cruise ships. Kind of true, sometimes. It's like, dude, you just crushed your union. Super yacht! Like that's... It's like it's a challenge. It's like it's spitting in our face because that's what it is. And it's not just him, by the way. By the way, a lot of people have increasingly sort of landed on the narrative that these rich people who want to go to space are just sort of like fleeing our world rather than like fixing our problems. The issue with that is that going to space is obviously very complex and expensive, more than $500 million expensive. So they do seem to be landing on, well, why go to Mars when there's the Pacific? Like, take a look at this. This is sales of super yachts. They were like massively up during the pandemic.
Gross.
An economic collapse. More super yachts, not yacht. Yachts are for like middle class people. Super yachts, cruise ships, but with like only room for three wealthy a-holes. So yeah, that's what's going on. Let's take a look at this. This, by the way, this is not that one. This is the Flying Fox. But Marissa, can you confirm he owns this too? Yeah. But so by the way, very important, like with DeVos, it's not like I've never had a boat. Maybe I'll go whole hog and build an, he already has crazy yachts. This is just his newer, bigger, crazy yacht.
I can't wait to get to a point in this country where billionaires, well, there are no billionaires, but that mega millionaires can only afford one yacht, you know, mm-hmm. just a mm-hmm. yacht. Like if we could just put it in yacht terms, mm-hmm. you're entitled to one yacht. You're not entitled to a super yacht or multiple super yachts.
You want to limit it. That makes
this
sense.
I just want to restate this though, John, like we are now emerging out of, we're just getting used to like new freedom. Oh yeah, I can go outside. Great. I'm getting vaccinated. This is wonderful. And we all knew this was coming. We all saw the stock market breaking so many, you know, whatever, like records during this pandemic. And we're like, but we're dying and out of work. I don't get it. You know, and then we're thankful for like the couple of stimulus checks that we got that all went to pay my taxes. God damn it. You know, like, oh, yay, a couple of stimulus checks. It allowed me to not be in poverty. That's cool. Meanwhile, the rich have just gotten richer. And I know every time Bernie Sanders says it, we're like, you turn off your brain because it's in the same tone and he says it all the time. But it is true. And it is true more now than ever. And it's getting even more disgusting and awful. And so, like, look, Biden's plans aren't going to cut it.
No.
Warren's plans for a wealth tax, that's a start. Still not going to cut it. We need to keep going. We need to keep pushing this because we literally cannot afford to have, we can't afford to have billionaires like this.
Yeah. $500 million. How much do you think it costs to gas up? I bet it's a lot. I bet it costs a lot to gas it up.
A cool
he's
mill.
Not even gonna be, he's not even going to be on it most of the time. It's not his house.
Yeah, let us on it.
What is he going to use it for, 2 weeks a year?
Let us stream on your yacht, bro.
Yeah, no, I got really sick when I was on that sealing vessel. So I don't know, it's so big, maybe you don't even feel like you're on the water. This weekend, Elon Musk hosted SNL, and we're not going to talk about it too much, but there are some people who wanted to, including hosts on Newsmax, which were predisposed to think that he did a good job, even though they admit that he hadn't watched it, which tells you all you really need to know about his fandom. But anyway, Newsmax had on a former Obama speechwriter, this David Litt, and wanted to ask him what he thought about Elon Musk. And it didn't go exactly as the Newsmax host had planned.
I did not watch Saturday Night Live. I watched the clips. The show's on too late, quite frankly. I don't think it's that funny anymore. What'd you think of Elon Musk's performance? This is the first time since 2015 we've had a non-athlete, non-entertainer on the show. The last person to do that and do well with great ratings, our former president, Donald Trump.
Well, Rob, it's a great question. I mean, what happened on SNL this weekend was that people made stuff up and then said it on television like it's true. And that actually happens pretty frequently in American TV. For example, in 2020, Dominion Voting System sued Newsmax over its false claims about election fraud. Newsmax was lying to its own viewers, and Newsmax had to settle that lawsuit. So actually, I just need to check in. Are you still telling that lie or are you telling new lies?
Wait, are we talking about, I'm sorry, David, are we talking about, do you want to talk about something completely non-related and try to catch me on a Monday morning totally off topic, or do you want to talk about Elon Musk?
Well, I can see why you don't want to talk about Dominion voting systems, because if you do, Newsmax could get sued and lose billions of dollars because these are lies.
That's pretty good. Funnier than anything I saw on SNL anyway. But
damn, yeah, funniest thing I've seen from former Obama speechwriters. Just kidding.
That's true. But, by the way, so obviously, like, if you're the host, this is inconvenient, you know, like being having it pointed out that you lied about the election being stolen so that like people would leave Fox for you. But I love his defense, which is, you trying to catch me on a Monday morning? Like, no, you can only identify that I didn't care about democracy and I prioritized my career over it on at least a Tuesday, man. Give me one day.
To be fair, if you ever did like a gotcha question to me in the morning, like every Monday, I'd be like, ugh, John, really? Really? Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, there was a little bit more of that. It doesn't last long because the Newsmax host is not interested, but here's how it closes out.
So if you'd like to talk about Saturday Night Live, I will do that with you, but obviously I'm not gonna talk about anything else right now. So you decide right now, in this moment on live television, go ahead.
Did Dominion voting systems have any impact on the 2020 election?
Oh, that's unfortunate because I was really excited about this interview. I didn't watch SNL on Saturday night, but I thought Elon Musk did an okay job. And he also said that he's got Asperger's. So I thought that was a fascinating component of the monologue. So David, we look forward to having him back on very soon again. That was a stellar interview. David Litt, thanks so much for joining us. We'll be right back.
Thanks so much. I don't understand what that interview is supposed to be. He said he was super excited to do it, but not excited enough to watch the episode of a show that he says Elon Musk did well in, even though he says he didn't watch it. Like, for instance, I didn't watch SNL. I did skim through it, and every time I saw Elon Musk, I advanced forward. And thus, I can't say that Elon Musk didn't do a good job or did do a good job, but he's found a way around that. He doesn't even need to watch it to know.
What was the angle anyway? Do you know what I mean? Like, what did he want this former Obama person to say about Elon Musk? I thought he was really good. Lies, you are a Democratic shill. You would say that because you love the billionaire. Like, no, I didn't like him. It's because you hate Mars. It's because you and your Democrat, like, you know, it's hard to know how they, how he was even going to play this on a Monday morning, you know, but like, yes. Oh God, Newsmax, you non-storied, but I love that this guy just decided to turn it on its head. That's what more people should be doing when they go on shows, is to actually just roast the hosts. And that's what I will do from now on, John.
Or, yeah, so many people are scared of losing their access. But if you never use it for anything, what's the point? Like, if you're being brought onto Fox News or something, if you never question anything, then what's the it's the same as having some other conservative on there. So I'm glad that this guy was willing to go on Newsmax and absolutely roast it. I will say, in reference to something that the guy said at the beginning, I didn't watch the full episode of Elon Musk because I just could not. But I have seen the episode with Donald Trump, and he's right that it got good ratings. But that does not mean that it was a good episode. It's not difficult to understand that people tuned in to see what would happen, and it was terrible because he had a complete inability to actually joke about himself.
Yep.
Terrible comic timing. He didn't seem to like the crew and they didn't seem to like him. It was a terrible, terrible episode. It just was one that happened to be watched a lot.
And thus anyway, we get to the heart of why SNL chooses their hosts. And we will talk about that in our top 10 list.
I love to see experimentation by government, especially when the goal is to better people's lives. We have an example of that actually with Canada. So they did this thing where in the Vancouver area, 50 homeless people were identified. They'd been homeless in the past 2 years. In spring of 2018, the government there gave them each a one lump sum payment of $7,500 Canadian and it told them, you can do whatever you want with the cash, but we are going to occasionally check in with you and just see how it changes your life situation. So you give people money, you trust that they will do whatever it is that they want to do. And then see what happens. So over the next year, they did follow up with them because they were participating in a randomized controlled trial. Their outcomes were compared to those of a control group. These were 65 other homeless people who were not given any of the cash, which I understand for scientific reasons why they have to do that, but it does seem a little bit mean. But anyway, both the cash recipients and the people in the control group got access to workshops and coaching focused on developing life skills and plans. So you either just get the training and the help, or you get the training and the help as well as money. And the results showed that the people who received cash transfers moved into stable housing faster and saved enough money to maintain financial security over the year of follow-up. They decreased their spending on drugs, tobacco, and alcohol by 39% on average, and increased spending on food, clothes, and rent, according to their self-reports. Now, there is a little bit more on this, even more amazing news or more amazing outcomes of the study, but Francesca, pretty interesting to just, it's not a lot of money that's necessary for this experiment, but those people's lives were actually improved, even over and above the normal sort of life coaching resources, things like that.
I mean, how many of us could say that with, what is it, like 5,000 US dollars or 6,000? I don't know the conversion, but how many of us could say that with, like, you know, a few thousand dollars, we could in a few months go from being homeless to having like a stable rent situation, you know, maybe a job prospect? Not many of us. That's not easy to do. That is incredibly hard to figure out how you're going to make $5,000, like get you off the streets and into something stable. So yes, and I just want to say something that we talked about earlier, and I know we're going to go into this more, but like, I am also floored by the ways that even the small stimulus in the United States, even though it was vastly under what we wanted it to be every single time, but has helped keep families out of poverty straight up. I mean, this last one in terms of, you know, paying folks who also have children, that goes a long way, but like, it's incredible what just a little bit of money will do. And I do think no Andrew Yang stan here at all, but that UBI is something we really need to talk about in the future for everybody. But anyway, I think talking about the unhoused is really, really critical.
Yeah. Yeah. Regardless of what you think about Andrew Yang or his other plans or his current political things that he's doing, getting people to think about it and talk about UBI, I think, is definitely a good thing. It doesn't take much money to improve people's lives, especially when you're talking about both in this case and also to a lesser extent, people who are getting the stimulus. A lot of these people are like, the system is set up that they are barely getting by.
Yes.
And so this extra money is a way bigger change to their actual situation than, you know, like throwing billions at Jeff Bezos or whatever. Maybe he can get an extra deck on his super yacht. I don't know. But anyway, I wanted to give you a little bit more information from the study because it was actually amazing. So people who received the cash infusions were even able to set some money aside, about $1,000 Canadian on average over the course of the year. The money provided by the program also had what they call trickle down impact. So I don't like the terminology considering the history, but they invested more in their children's well-being and needs as well as helping out family members. So they weren't the only ones who were helped by this. But what's even more amazing than that is that giving out the cash transfers actually saved the broader society money. Enabling 50 people to move into housing faster saved the shelter system $8,100 per person over the year for a total savings of $405,000. That's more than the value of the cash transfers, which mean that the transfers paid for themselves. So these people's lives are improved, their families' lives are improved, their kids' lives are improved, and it actually made the city a bit of money. And that's with an experiment of just 50 people. Now imagine if you were to scale this up. And so it's the sort of experiment that I assume many conservatives, their knee-jerk reaction would be, how could you just give money to these people? But in fact, it did actually help them get back on their feet, and it saved money in the long run. It's pretty amazing.
Yes, it's because fiscal conservatism makes no fiscal sense whatsoever. It just doesn't work. The idea that you attach a bunch of strings to someone getting employment, to someone getting welfare, to someone getting child assistance, to someone getting Medicaid is utter BS. It does not work. It just straps people with more and more debt, more and more sort of they corners them. Meanwhile, giving folks money, no strings attached. Oh, and look, access to like classes and some, you know, some training, some skills. Again, no strings attached, but here you go. Turns out that works just fine. That works even better. But no, because poor people can't be trusted to be responsible because their predicament is their own fault. See how this works? It's perfect. And that's what conservatives teach us to believe. That's what even liberals teach us to believe. That's what this cruel economy teaches us to believe. And I think we really need to start to undo that. I mean, and it can be as simple as, you know, we've all heard, oh, you don't give a homeless person money because, you know, they're just going to spend it on X, Y, or Z. They're going to spend it on drugs. They're going to spend it on alcohol. No, turns out they don't. It turns out they're not necessarily homeless because of anything that they did wrong. They are homeless because they couldn't afford a $200 ticket, or they couldn't afford, you know, a medical expense, and now they're on the street.
100%. Yeah.
I'm so serious.
So
today,
good job,
John.
Canada. It was pretty serious.
So serious.
We are very excited to welcome to the program for the first time a candidate for New York's 12th district, Rana Abdelhamid. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Very glad to have you here. You know, I, like many people, saw, I believe, your first campaign ad that was being spread around Twitter, and it's obviously very striking. For people who might not be familiar with it, who might not know yet about your candidacy, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, for sure. So my name is Rana Abdelhamid. I'm from Queens, New York. I grew up in a working class immigrant community here. My father owned a small business deli when I was growing up. And I grew up within the context of just rising rent costs, gentrification, seeing my father and my family lose our small business, but then also a lot of the violence that impacted my community after 9/11. As someone who grew up Muslim, who was part of a Muslim community, my community was targeted by a lot of the NYPD unconstitutional surveillance, stop and frisk policies. But also I myself experienced a hate-based attack that inspired me to organize at a very young age, going around my neighborhood, training women in martial arts, not even self-defense at the time, and trying to create and think about what safety looks like for all of us. And that has developed over the past 10 years into really thinking about economic security, physical security, housing security, and being part of various organizing movements across the city.
Yeah. You know, it's like sometimes it's nice to acknowledge progress, but then, like you rightly point out, not only the massive state-based harassment and surveillance and everything, but then just the massive uptick in hate crimes and assault following 9/11. And now many years later, we're experiencing another wave of targeting the AIPI community. So sometimes disappointing in how little we've actually progressed. But Thank you for telling us a little bit about your experience. So tell me about the decision to run, because not only is this a congressional race, but it's also you're going to be going up against an incumbent Democrat, which adds a specific flavor to it. Tell me about making that decision.
Yeah, I mean, this is a decision that came within the context of, a deep understanding of a lot of the inequity that I experienced, my family, my community has experienced within this city over the past 28 years under the current representative's leadership, but also within the context of the pandemic. Queens was the epicenter of the pandemic. Queens is where we have essential workers, frontline workers, a lot of working class communities who didn't have access to the quality care that they needed when we were impacted by COVID. And so I remember one night, my mom, who is an educator, who contracted the virus very early on during March, she, during the nights when she was struggling to breathe, doctors said she had a better chance surviving at home than at a Queens hospital. And for me, that was really horrifying because I knew that wasn't the case across the city, right? Like, we knew that there was such deep inequity that people did have access to healthcare, and there was access to healthcare that could be afforded, but that wasn't the case across the city. And there was this reality of food insecurity with housing insecurity, watching our small businesses being shut down, and really knowing that we deserve so much better. Because I've seen over and over again throughout my entire life how New Yorkers have come, supported my family, how we have supported each other, and how we deserve someone who's going to throw down for us the way we throw down for ourselves.
Yeah. So tell me about the current incumbent then, Carolyn Maloney. This has been, a tumultuous year. Obviously, politics has been very in people's faces with the pandemic, the social movements of the last year, the transition from Trump now into Biden. So Representative Maloney, what has she been doing? What has she not been doing as the representative of that district?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been under Maloney's leadership for longer than I've been. I mean, she's been in Congress for longer than I've been alive. And throughout my life, rent has only increased and life has only become more unaffordable in the city for working families like mine. And so under her leadership, I've seen how, she's someone who supported former commissioner of the NYPD, Ray Kelly, someone who was the architect of the NYPD surveillance programs that impacted my community, who, when I was being, assaulted for wearing the hijab as a Muslim woman because of this narrative of Muslim women being oppressed, she was wearing a burqa as a costume on the House floor to advocate for the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. This is someone who at some point in her career— who during her career, she's been anti-vaxxer and has still not apologized for linking vaccines to autism. She's someone who takes the majority of her money from corporations, from real estate, backed Amazon coming into Queens. So there's just a lot of things in her record that have not been progressive, but also have not centered the communities in her district, our safety, our security, what we deserve to be able not only to survive in the city, but also to thrive in the city.
Okay, so let me do something I like to do, especially with prospective candidates. So right now you're a candidate, you're looking forward to a year and a half basically campaign against Representative Maloney, and then eventually hopefully a general election. Let's say that you weren't. Let's say that you were in her position right now. It's not Representative Maloney. You are the representative. With what's going on in politics today, what would you be doing this week? What would you be focusing on? What would you be advocating for? If they bring you on, Stephen Colbert brings you on to talk politics, what are you choosing to shine a spotlight on?
I mean, we're watching the challenges around the Postal Service unfold right now at the congressional level. And obviously, Carolyn Maloney is someone who's on the oversight committee and who has not been as progressive as many congressional members have been on this issue, really taking into account the harm that has been done by DeJoy, by current leadership, in the ways in which the delays and the lack of just urgency around creating change to ensure that the Postal Service is working for working class communities that aren't getting their medical care on time, right? Their medicine on time, that small businesses that are not being able to deliver packages on time, right? So many of our communities, especially working class communities, are impacted by a stagnating Postal Service And that issue is not being taken seriously by her. And actually, she's willing to compromise and not pushing enough to ensure that DeJoy is and the board is being removed. That we're finding alternative leadership and we're creating urgency around this issue as we're seeing the impacts in our communities.
Yeah, it is amazing that he's still in that position. After all of what happened last year, I don't understand it and I never will. Okay, let me ask you another question though, because obviously, look, you're showing yourself willing to battle Democrats that you know are quite different than you politically, ideologically. You're going up against Carolyn Maloney. So right now, Biden has these plans, and obviously, none of the Republicans wanted to get literally any of it done. Mitch McConnell says, "My goal is to stop you from doing everything." But those are not the only obstacles that Joe Biden faces. Virtually every plan that he puts forward, Joe Manchin has some issue with it, and then there's others, Senator Sinema, and some that are even more cowardly. They don't actually identify that they're against this stuff, but there clearly are. And so, strategically, you're a progressive. What is the best strategy to deal not just with the Republican opposition? I mean, clearly, I'm sure that you're willing to fight them, but the Democrats that are standing in the way of Biden's agenda, let alone an even more progressive agenda, which they would probably oppose too. What's the strategy for dealing with those members of the Democratic caucus that are proving to be an obstacle?
I think it's really important for progressives right now to remain steadfast and focused on what our objectives are, right? When we say we want a $15 minimum wage, when we say we want to cancel student debt, these are things that should have already been done, right? There is urgency that our communities are feeling right now. There's a lot of pressure that our communities are feeling right now. I don't think that this is the time to compromise. I don't think that this is a time in which we should be willing to back down on some of these things that are really about life and death for people, for our communities that are struggling to make ends meet, that are struggling to survive, who are losing their healthcare because it's tied to employment. And this is a prime opportunity because at a grassroots level, we're seeing that this is what people want, right? Otherwise, Biden, I don't think, would be making such huge gestures and would be really fighting for these things. But he understands that this is what voters want in this country. Yeah. And so that's what I am going to be committed to fight for.
Okay. So you, a couple of fairly recent things. First of all, happy birthday. I know that your birthday was just a few days ago. So it was your birthday recently. You're also, are you the most recent endorsement by the Justice Democrats? I think you might be the most recent. So tell me a little bit about that endorsement, but also, you know, past Justice Democrats have won in races that were, you know, they weren't necessarily assumed that they were likely to win. Are there lessons that you're drawing from the experience of the Justice Democrats from now representatives like Bowman and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others like that?
Yes, absolutely. First of all, I feel really excited to be backed by Justice Democrats. It means a lot to me and my community and to a lot of the organizers who've been working with me on this campaign, co-creating this campaign. And that feels really good. And I'm learning so much, particularly from Dr. Bowman's campaign. I think the ways in which his campaign was built from the ground up in coalition with a lot of different groups is the way in which I hope to build this campaign, thinking about the progressive movements that have existed within this district and honoring them by bringing them together and learning from what's already happening on the ground. And that's something that I think is going to be hard. But as an organizer, I'm really, really excited to go about doing that.
Okay. And if anyone watching this wants to support your campaign or if they're local and they want to maybe get involved, how would they do that?
Yes, so you could go to runaforcongress.com, so RANAforCongress.com. And there's a place to volunteer, to sign up to volunteer, to sign up for our listserv. And of course, I would not, you know, be a good candidate if I did not ask. If you are able to donate, please do donate to our campaign. That is very important to us. We are not taking any corporate money and we're really relying on grassroots contributions.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank you for taking time out of what I assume has got to be a very busy campaign already. And speaking to our audience, we look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.